Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the mysterious and fantastic origins of the popular magical role-playing board game Dungeons and Dragons. And we will trace the beginnings of Oriental Gothic magical fiction back to William Beckford's early 19th century novel, Vathek, a decadent Arabian Nights fantasy with diabolical themes. And thrown through Lord Dunsany's creation of exotic fantasy realms for his magical tales, to the early 20th century master Clark Ashton Smith, who created the first Dying Earth setting that he called Zothique, the last continent under the dim sun of a world soon to end. Now, this idea was carried on by sci-fi fantasy writer Jack Vance in his own cycle of Dying Earth stories, in which he created the unique system of wizard spell casting that was adopted by Dungeons and Dragons game players. So, if you want to learn about the Spell for Learning systems or the excellent Prismatic Spray, tune in and we'll learn how it was done in the days before Harry Potter. Now, this is a kind of a walk down memory lane and nostalgia and one thing or another, but it is important to the modern revival of actual magic that we actually do practice and study and do. Because before we actually practiced and studied and did it, or do it, there was this romantic revival. And we were doing this sort of thing first in fiction, fantasy fiction, which we're going to discuss. And then we went from that to role-playing games, which was Dungeons and Dragons. And then we went from Dungeons and Dragons to, my gosh, we can actually do this stuff. So, it went in that kind of a sequence. And so that's why this particular tracing of the current here is important to and relates to our Hermetic tradition. It actually does. So let's go back and let's go back to 1800. Year 1800, and what was referred to then as the Gothic Revival. Now, I want you to kind of put this in perspective. Realize that Barrett's Magus, most of us are familiar with that, Barrett's Magus, which was a synthesis of Agrippa and some other magical grimoires that Barrett put together. This was came out about 1800, and this is one of the highlights of the Gothic Revival. Sir Walter Scott, of course, wrote these Gothic romances, and Horace Walpole, The Castle of Otranto, and all of this. Now, what also happened during this Gothic period, is that some very, very wealthy eccentrics in Britain, you know, and the British are noted for their wealthy eccentrics. We discussed one on a previous show, which does relate to this, by the way, and that was Sir Francis Dashwood and his Hellfire Club, which was actually, as we pointed out, it was a sort of a Renaissance pagan kind of a thing, or pagan revelry was mainly the thing, not so much Hellfire, but still. Dashwood was a very, very wealthy and prominent figure, and had a large estate, and could create this Gothic, this Gothic atmosphere. And he actually had a ruined abbey that he built on his place. And Dashwood, this was back around the time of the American Revolution, and of course Ben Franklin belonged to it. Well, or whatever. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning that is that in 1800, Gothic revival was still going on, and a man who was probably twice as rich as Sir Francis, if not three or four times more rich, the richest man in England, was a young genius by the name of William Beckford. Now, William Beckford was the prodigal but he was a prodigious child prodigy son of William Beckford Sr., who was the wealthiest man in England, made his fortune exploiting slaves in Jamaica, which of course wasn't very nice, but old man Beckford decided that his boy, his only child, was going to take over his empire. So he gave him the best education that all of his money could buy. And so the kid was fluent in French by the time he was 10. And he had even had Mozart, believe it or not, was over in England. And Beckford paid Mozart enough to, or Mozart came and gave him piano lessons. And so Beckford, young Woodman Beckford, was really, really had a wonderful education, had the best tutors and the best, and as I say, he was just as fluent in French as he was in English. Now, the kid, as he grew up, really didn't want anything to do with business. He actually didn't like people very much. And he was kind of like Howard Hughes, you know, he liked things better than people. And he didn't really want to do any business. He just wanted to have fun in a very intellectual and very sophisticated and very naughty sort of way. And I'm sure Crowley probably admired and in some cases imitated Beckford's and also Dashwood. So Beckford, his father died. His father died when he was 10, and he inherited this vast, he had an estate that was 1,000 acres. Not just 1,000 acres. And he walled it all off and transformed it all into landscape, different fantasy environments. This was like a giant Disneyland for him. And he collected all kinds of objects to art, and he built a huge tower that was about 400 feet high, and this Gothic tower. And his house was so fantastic that whenever he did invite somebody to go through it, they were absolutely amazed at all the art and the various themes that he created. He had different rooms for different themes, but mainly William Beckford was mainly fascinated by the Arabian Nights. He'd been over to France. He went over to France several times. In fact, every time he'd have some scandalous affair, his family would suggest that he hide out in France for a while, and then he'd come back, and his idea of covering up an affair, to just give you an idea of how little he cared about his reputation, he he started a public affair with his best friend's wife so he could have a private affair with his best friend. This is where he was. He was in every kind of thing you could think of. And so he was particularly fascinated by the Arabian Nights. Now, this was before Richard Burton's translation, and we're all familiar with English translation. The Arabian Nights had been translated over in France by Galen. Now, this is a very good, romantic translation of the 1001 Nights. And the French were in their Gothic period. They were absolutely fascinated with these Oriental, especially Arabian type fantasies. Now, at the same time, this is very interesting, and of course it relates to our Hermetic tradition. At the same time that Beckford was getting involved in this, writing his own Arabian fantasy, Gothic, at the same time, Gerard de Nerval, one of the Hashishin over in France, the decadent Hashishin, he toured the Middle East and did his book called Journey to the Orient, which featured the Queen of the Morning and Solomon, Prince of the Jinn. Now, there's a lot of similarities between Vathek, the Arabian fantasy, that novel that Beckford wrote, and Queen of the Morning and Solomon, Prince of the Jinn. Now, Queen of the Morning, Solomon, Prince of the Jinn is a strange Turkish version of the Masonic Hiram Abiff legend. And we've discussed this on other Hermetic Hour shows, but this story of Gerard de Nerval, that he claimed that he collected in an Istanbul coffee house over about five sessions, drinking coffee, and I don't know what he was smoking while he was drinking the coffee, but anyway, he collected this story, which Rudolf Steiner liked it so much that he called it the Temple Legend and actually included it in some of his work. So it's become, and Manly Hall features, there's a painting in Manly Hall's big book of the casting of the Brazen Sea. We have gone ahead and put it into the fifth degree of the Craterapoa, so it's found a home there. But it's similar to Vathek, and I don't know whether, they both came out around the same time, because Beckford, when he did Vathek, he wrote it in French. He was just as fluent in French as he was in English, and he wrote it in French because the French were the ones that were really into the Oriental Arabian Nights kind of stuff at that time. And finally, after two or three French editions, he finally got an English edition of it. And it's, by the way, this novel, if you would like to read it, and I encourage you to do so, it's fascinating. Dover Books has, and this is always in stock, they have a collection of three Gothic novels from this period, The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, Vathek by William Bedford, and The Vampire by John Polidori, and he was that was Lord Byron's friend and Mary Shelley's friend when they all had the contest, to see who could write the grisliest ghost story. And Polidori wrote The Vampire, and Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, and Lord Byron started to write something and got bored with it. Now, this is called Three Gothic Novels. It's edited by E.F. Lear, and Vathek is in there. And I think one thing about Vathek that Beckford really did his research. There's a lot of magic in Vathek. There really is. And the theme is, and this is important, is that Vathek is a caliph. In other words, he's a supreme priest and imam and Sultan all rolled into one. He's a caliph, he is into every kind of sensuality and every kind of extravagance that you can imagine. Now this is important because this is the sort of thing that in this sense, Beckford is trumping Scheherazade. He really is. He's exaggerating the opulence and the richness and the extravagance of the Arabian Nights. He's carrying it to extremes. In other words, Vathek doesn't just eat. He doesn't eat pheasants. He eats peacock stuffed with caviar. Everything that Vathek does, he does it in fantastic extravagance. And because Beckford was that way, he was a fantastically extravagant individual, and Vathek was his own fantasy. Interestingly enough, Vathek's mother in the story is even more evil and depraved than he is, and she's a sorceress. I'm going to read you a little bit of, just give you an idea of what this, how this goes here. I got one. Yeah. That's where he gets started on this. Terrifying as these prodigies were, this impression upon him was no more than momentary and served only to stimulate his love of the marvelous. Instead, therefore, of returning to his palace, he persisted in the resolution of abiding where the Indian had vanished from his view. One night, however, while he was walking as usual on the plain, the moon and stars were eclipsed at once, and a total darkness ensued, and the earth trembled beneath him, and a voice came forth, the voice of Gaur, who, in accents more sonorous than thunder, thus addressed him. Wouldst thou devote thyself to me, adore the terrestrial influences, and abjure Mohammed? On these conditions, I will bring thee to the palace of subterranean fire, and there thou shalt behold, in immense depositories, the treasury which the stars have promised thee, and which will be considered by those intelligences whom thou shalt thus render perfidious. It was from thence I brought my magic sword, and it is there that Suleiman ben Daoud reposes, surrounded by the talismans that control the world. Oh boy, this is the Arabian Nights carried to exponential limits. So, of course, I think is what we might call British, Oriental, Gothic. And it is very magical because Vathek does go down into the caverns and to some degree, although there certainly is retribution and all that, there is irony to it. But he does acquire magical power or whatever. So, the Arabian Nights is what starts this off, and Vathek is the first of these British fantasy novels. It's the first; it really is just a start, and it does influence Carcass and Smith. It influences, in turn, Lord Bessity. It influences Carcass and Smith, and influences Jack Vance, and on and on and on until it finally influences Dungeons and Dragons. Now, I'll show you how that works. Now, Vathek, very popular at the time. It's the only thing that Beckford ever did, by the way, that, you know, the rest of his life was devoted to being a playboy and an art collector and a dilettante. But Vathek was his masterpiece. And set the tone for the whole elaborate scheme of what we now call heroic fantasy, sword and sorcery, that sort of thing. You know, Robert Howard, Michael Moorcock, and Fritz Lieber, they all start with, I think, magical fantasy. Now, about, let's say, almost 100 years later, we can trace this through to Gordon Drexler Plunkett. Now, I know that nobody out there knows who Gordon Drexler Plunkett is. Yeah, anybody know who Gordon Drexler Plunkett? That's Lord Dunsany, by the way. He wrote under the name Lord Dunsany. And Lord Dunsany, of course, was a member of Parliament. He was a lord, and he was a soldier, and he was one of these Britishers that did everything. But what Lord Dunsany really, really liked to do was write fantasy. And he took spinning off from Vithek. He decided to create his own fantasy worlds with his own gods. He started off with a little fantasy called the Gods of Pegana and created his own pantheon and his own fantasy world, his own names and everything, kind of his own Alice in Wonderland or his own earlier Land of Oz, and beautifully done, very, very poetic. And did a whole series of stories like this. I know that one of Dunsany's characters, I'll just mention it right now so I don't forget to mention it. Dunsany had a little story about a character that was trying to escape from this god, this little god who was called Chun the Unavoidable. And Chun the Unavoidable could not be avoided. And no matter where this protagonist of his story hit out, Chun would pop up and say, "I'm Chun the Unavoidable." And he became so obsessed with the idea of getting away from Chun that he finally threw himself off the edge of the world and he was falling into endless space or something like that, and sure enough, down in his boot there was Chun the Unavoidable. And this eventually, Jack Vance picked this up, and he did one, and I think he forgot that he got it from Dunsany. And then it showed up. R.R. Martin says it was one of his famous, one of the modern science fiction writers that liked Jack Vance, and he said it was his favorite story, Chun the Unavoidable. Dunsany originally created Chun the Unavoidable. These things are all interconnected. So Dunsany is followed by the first fantasy writer to create the Dying Earth theme. And that wasn't Jack Vance, by the way. The first Dying Earth theme in fantasy was created by the American master Clark Ashton Smith. Now, Clark Ashton Smith, fortunately, is finally undergoing a revival. All through, for the last, I know it's about 20 years, everybody forgot about Clark Ashton Smith. And Clark Ashton Smith was one of the greatest, if not, on par with Lovecraft and Howard, and one of the greatest of the American fantasy writers, and a masterpiece. I mean, the man was a poet, he was a sculptor, he was a Californian too, and his stories have a unique Californian flavor to them. In fact, I'll mention it right now. One of his stories, and I think the name of it is The Master of the Crabs. All right, the story is, it's in the Zothique collection, called The Master of the Crabs. Now, Smith spent most of his life in California, Northern California, Central California, and apparently, as far as I can tell, he wasn't a sailor, but he was very, very familiar with nautical terminology and nautical and a little more than just terminology. He'd been out on the open water in a sailboat. This is pretty obvious. And he's got this story called Master of the Crabs, which takes place in Zothique. And by the way, Zothique is a million years in the future when the sun is starting to go dim. But if that sounds familiar, this is where it got started. This is back in the 1920s now that he comes up with this. Zothique is the last continent left on Earth. And all the rest of them have sunk. It's just Zothique. And Zothique is actually kind of a desert. It's pretty much influenced by the Arabian Nights. It's a desert with a lot of ruins. And it has an Arabian flavor to it. But still, the sun is dying, and that's the last continent or whatever. But this particular story, Master of the Crabs, it is haunting to me because I'm a sailor, and I'm very familiar with sailing out to Catalina Island and around the island and all that. And when you go around the west end of Catalina, any of you have, it's a whole different, it's almost like going into a different eco zone. When you're to leeward of Catalina, between, say, Marina del Rey or Catalina, in that channel, what's called the Catalina Channel, the water really on the seas is pretty deep. It's a couple thousand feet deep out there, but yeah, and you're 20 miles, in some instances, 30 miles from shore. But when you go around the west end of Catalina, that is a nasty, rough piece of water. And it most of the time, and the current is such that you really do get kind of worried about staying off a lee shore, and you really do. And then there's to find the entrance to Catalina Harbor, which is a little narrow harbor, and there's this rock straight up called the Lobster's Claw. And then the entrance to the harbor is almost hidden. And Smith describes this in this story that's supposed to take place a million years in the future in this fantasy. He describes this almost exactly as if he's going around West End and going into Catalina Harbor. It's spooky. What is for me, anyway. So he's very much a Californian, and you can tell. This is why Zothique has a sort of a desert flavor, Arabian flavor. Now, Clark Ashton Smith, as I said, was a poet and a sculptor, and he was one of these people who's completely self-educated. He dropped out of grammar school and decided to educate himself, and read the Oxford Dictionary, the big one, all the way through several times, and then read the whole Encyclopedia Britannica through several times. And that was his education. Now, Smith, let me give you a good feeling on Zothique here. By the way, if you're interested, The book Zothique was a complete collection of all 16 Zothique stories, which appeared in Weird Tales, back in the 20s and 30s. Now, this particular book, Zothique, is edited with an introduction by my very good friend and mentor, Lynn Carter. And I've got a used copy of it here, which I was able to get for about $9. It was a readable used copy. But I've seen new copies of this. It's a paperback. It's a Valentine paper. I've seen new copies of this thing going for $500 now. Smith is in Smith is having a revival. I would recommend, rather than try to fish up some copy of Zofeek, The Return of the Sorcerer, available from Science Fiction Book Club. You can get it through Amazon. It's hardback. That's a collection of what they claim are the best of Smith's stories, and I would go for that. There's three Zofeek stories in that. Smith created a several world. His prehistoric world was called Hyperborea, and then his medieval world was called Avignon, which was because he also was a Francophile, and he created a fantastic province of medieval France that he wrote Gothic stories in. Now, all of these stories involve magic and sorcery and wizards. As Smith was very, very, very much, he wasn't perhaps a magician himself, but he was really, really steeped in the occult. And so when he wrote stories about wizards, he really had the feel. He really had the feel of a magical story. More so than Lovecraft, actually. Smith was more into the occult than Lovecraft was. Now, I'm going to read the poem Zofeek, which is in the book Zofeek. It introduces the book. He who has trod the shadows of Zofeek, that looked upon the cold red sun oblique, henceforth returns to no anterior land, but haunts a latter coast where cities crumble in the dark sea sand, and dead gods drink the brine. And he who has known the gardens of Zofeek, where bleed the fruits torn by the smorg's beak, savors no fruit of greener hemispheres in arbors uttermost. In sunset cycles of the sombre years, he sips an amaranth wine. And he who has loved the wild girls of Zofeek shall come not back to a gentler love to seek, nor know the vampires from the lover's kiss. For him the scarlet ghost of Lilith from time's last necropolis rears amorous and malign. He who has sailed the galleys of Zofeek and seen the looming of strange spire and peak must face again the sorcerer sent typhoon and take the steerer's post on far port oceans by the shifted moon or the reshapen sign of old Zofeek. Now, so this is really flavorful stuff, but it's magic, and most of his stories, or not all of them, especially the Zofeek stories, involve very, very accomplished wizards and their attempts to find treasures and do all the various things that wizards of yore supposedly did. Or we wouldn't like them to do if we're fantasizing. And the stories have a certain irony to them, and they have, but one of the things that I'd like to say, the comparison, because we need to compare Smith and Vance, after Smith passed away Smith died in 1954, an old man, and then about 10 years later, along came Jack Vance, who had been writing his Dying Earth stories. I've got to say this, Jack Vance, as far as I know, now I've read all of Jack Vance's Dying Earth stories, and I've read all of the stories that people have written based on Jack Vance's diary, but I haven't read all of Jack Vance's commentaries. But I've read enough of Jack Vance's commentaries to know that he doesn't really want to give Smith any credit, and he should, because Smith came up with the first Tight Earth idea. And so, but regardless of that, Jack Vance, with his Dying Earth stories, which are, by the way, broken into two: The Dying Earth, and then there's The Eyes of the Overworld. It's two separate books. And one, The Eyes of the Overworld, is written almost 20 years later. And the Dying Earth stories, the original Dying Earth stories, are much closer to Clark Ashton Smith. Then, when he comes back with The Eyes of the Overworld, he gets very cynical. And he creates this character, Cudjel. And Cudjel is a kind of a rogue, and Cudjel outsmarts himself continually. And they're almost, the Cudjel stories are almost satire. You can almost say that they're fantasy, yeah, but they're satire. I like them, but they're not as straightforwardly magical fantasy as the original Dying Earth stories. The original Dying Earth stories are very much like Smith, except that Vance, Vance's characters are a bit more, shall we say, accessible. I hate to use that editor's term, but I mean, your characters are more accessible. Well, in other words, the reason I'm saying that is that Smith, like Beckford earlier and all, Smith is a storyteller. And he is not letting you, he's not letting the character interfere with the story at all. The character, whatever the character does, it has to advance the story. And that's it. And basically what Smith is really concerned with is telling the story. And the character serves to tell the story. And so the story has a kind of a formal quality to it. Now, Vance, his characters, wizards and all the rest, they're a bit more rounded, and their dialogue's more ironic and wryly humorous and all that than Smith's. So Vance, for some people, may be more fun to read. I enjoy both of them, of course, but the important thing to Dungeons and Dragons here with Vance is, and where this finally comes out, is that Vance, like Smith, has his Dying Earth magic works. Science is died out. Technology, well, there's some evidences of it sitting around in little pockets, but mainly magic is now the thing that works. And magic works if you have the old grimoires and you know the old spells and you know the, and you study me, and you can, and you, you know, if you're an accomplished magician, you can accomplish virtually anything. I mean, you really have the power. Magic, and the magicians in both Smith and Vance, the magicians, their skill and their expertise is the main force of the story and whatever. Now, with Vance, where Vance really influenced Dungeons and Dragons, with all these, this whole cycle influences Dungeons and Dragons, because Dungeons and Dragons is role-playing. It's a role-playing game. And they've got to have a role to play. And this is where his role all develops, is in fantasy fiction. But what Vance came up with was an actual magical technique that was in some ways kind of close to what magicians actually, in a way, kind of did. But it was very clever. In a sense, it works this way. If you're a wizard, in the Jack Vance Dying Earth story, you're a wizard, And what you do is, if you're going out on a mission or going out on a quest, and you know what you're going for, you know what you're liable to run into, and you have a whole selection from your grimoires, you have a whole selection of different spells that you can arm yourself with. Now, you got to have a very good memory, and you got to really be able to memorize. You have to really, really have a good memory. And if you're a really well-trained magician, if you're a really well-trained magician and you have a lot of experience, you could memorize five really powerful spells. If you're not that good a magician, maybe you can memorize a couple of powerful spells and a few little minor spells that you might use for different things. But a powerful magician can get about five of these spells that he's going to need for his particular expedition. Now, you D&D people, you're starting to realize here what's going on. And by the way, right before he died, Jerry Gygax, the guy that started Dungeons and Dragons. Just before he died, he admitted that Jack Vance was a big influence on him. And, you know, so what it is, you're the Jack Vance type magician. See, so you got to memorize for the particular adventure that you're going on. You memorize these spells, and you got them. And if so, when you run into the monster or the villains or the Deodons or whatever it is you run into, you can whip one of these spells on them. But once you use that spell, it's out of your head. To use it again, you'd have to go back to the book, and you'd have to spend a whole night memorizing it again. Yeah, and so this is the way it works. Now, one of the spells I said here in the abstract, I said, one of the spells was the spell of forlorn insistence. Oh boy, and that's that. The spell of forlorn insistence, and that's a big one. If you hit somebody with that, you can put them permanently. Seal them up in an egg-like container and put them several thousand feet underground and leave them there. And how the dickens are they going to get out of that? You know, that's forlorn insistence. And the excellent prismatic spray is another one. And you can hit them. You can hit them with a thousand shards of what amounts to broken glass and impale them with that one. And there's there's lots of you can go through Vance's work and by the way, there's the Vance imitators, and there were very a lot of people imitated Vance, and with his own permission and did stories set in Vance's environment under the Dying Earth, and there's a collection of those that Science Fiction Book Clubs put out called Songs of the Dying Earth. And those stories, and they even got this edited by R.R. Martin, Game of Thrones, you know. I mean, he edited it, and he wrote one himself. A Night at the Tarn House, and oh, boy, that's a great story. So you might want to, if you're going to get The Dying Earth by Vance, and by the way, The Complete Dying Earth is what you want to get. That's what gives you all the Cujo stories and the Eyes of the Overworld and Dying Earth. Yet The Complete Dying Earth by Vance, and also yet Songs of the Dying Earth by all of the science fiction writers and fantasy writers that wanted to write Dying Earth stories. And so, boy, out of all of those, you can get yourself a terrific collection of spells if you want to get them. Now, as you know, and now, by the way, I never did play Dungeons and Dragons, but as we all know, it's a role-playing game. It still is. It's very, very popular. In fact, it was so popular back in the 60s that they had these communes that kids lived in called war houses, and they'd live in a place, and they just lived to play Dungeons and Dragons. They got so much into this role playing thing. I was telling Zandri tonight that I can remember. For a while, I was in the Society for Creative Anachronism, and I'll be fairly athletic. I was out there wearing armor and with a rattan sword and a shield and a steel helmet and all that, and plate armor and everything, bashing each other. And I remember Oberon hit me over the head one time so hard that I saw stars for about half an hour. But I was in a secondhand bookstore, and through the shelves I heard these two young guys talking, describing a battle they'd had, sword and buckler battle they'd had, and I'm listening to this from the other side of the shelf, and I could swear they were so realistic the way they were talking about this and joking about it, talking about it, going on about it, that I was sure that there were a couple of SCA fighters. And I expected to, find a couple of high school football player types over there. And I went around the edge, and they weren't high school football players at all. They were, I will use a disparaging term, but these kids were not athletic at all. And I said, "You guys in the SCA?" And they looked at me and they said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, gosh, you sound like a couple of SCA fighters." And they said, "No, we're talking about a D&D game." They really got into it. I mean, they really, really got into it. So, however, as I said, part of the D&D, at least the wizard structures, in D&D, you can take a different roles. You can be a fighter or you can be a wizard. But the wizards, if you're going to be a wizard, then you're under the influence, of course, naturally, of Jack Vance, who, of course, was under the influence of Smith, who was under the influence of Dusty, who was under the influence of Beckford. So we trace it all right on back. So I hope, in a way, that this is sparks you to look up some of this material. For the reason being that this fiction that we've been talking about tonight, especially Smith and Vifix, Vifix's a little dated, but Smith and Vance, you want to really get the feel of romantic, magical, you feel like this is fiction for wizards. I mean, this is high magic and in a marvelously imaginative environment. So I would really, really recommend both reading. In fact, I think one of our guys was saying this just a little long ago, Dying Earth is what introduced him to magic. Dying Earth, The Complete Dying Earth is one book. Songs of the Dying Earth, that's people who wrote very good stories based on Vance's Dying Earth. And then, of course, Clark Ashton Smith, The Return of the Sorcerer. If you can get a copy of Zothique, well, that's fine. But the one that I think you really ought to look for is Return of the Sorcerer by Smith, and I'll give you a really good handle on this. Now, I just got an email from Jeffrey James, and for those of you who don't remember who Jeffrey James is, he's been on the show before. Jeffrey James is a dear friend and colleague of mine from years back, and Jeffrey James is the translator and author of The Enochian Magic of Dr. John Dee, which is one of the best books on the original manuscripts and work of Dee and Kelly. And what Jeff has done is he has written a novel called The Sorcerer. And this novel is based upon Dee and Kelly and their misadventures and their adventures in Britain and on the continent. And I read it. In fact, I read it right before we went to Atlanta last year for the seasonal initiations down in Atlanta. And I was surprised, because Jeff is a real good writer, but this is really, this he has made Dee and Kelly really come alive, and this is the best thing I've ever read, best fiction I've ever read based on them. Now, there have been, I'm not going to mention the other writers, but there have been other writers who have written fictional books on Dee and Kelly and their adventures, but this is the best. This is far and away the best one. And Jeff's got a publisher now, and he's going to have this as soon as we get it available on Amazon. We're going to have Jeff on the show, and we'll talk about it. And but I don't, you know, as I said, I told Jeff, I said, let's wait till you get it right there on Amazon, and then we'll bring you on, and we'll spend a show talking about The Sorcerer. So that's coming up. Should be possibly in 2 weeks, hopefully. Next week, we are doing our regular transcribed. What? Yeah. We're doing the transcribed chapter on Hermetic Kabbalah. Now, that's for those of you who have not, regardless of whether you have or whether you haven't, you may have Kabbalah somewhere else, but this is Hermetic Kabbalah. And, of course, so be sure and even if you heard it before, you need to hear it again, because, Kabbalah goes in one ear and out the other, unfortunately. So next week, Hermetic Kabbalah, and the week after that, hopefully, Jeffrey James and the Sorcerer. And meanwhile, good magic. Bye-bye.